Krishna Krishna Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Hare Krishna, Hare
Haribol, 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 Nithai Gaura Haribol. Nithai Gaura Haribol, 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 Haribol. Jaya Jaya Prabhupada, 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 Jaya Prabhupada, 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 Prabhupada. Jai Om Vishnu Pad Padamam Spadibraj Kacharyaras Tacharya Sata Su Sriman His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai Sri Sri Gaunatai Ki Jai Sri Sri Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ji Ki Jai Sri Sri Radha Rasbihari Ji Ki Jai Gaur Premanandi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga, Gauranga Permanent. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Okay. Hare Krishna. So what group is this that we're talking to here? Do you have a name for this group or?
ISKCON Youth Forum.
This is the ISKCON Youth Forum. Okay, good. I think last time I was here in Bombay, I had a meeting with the ISKCON Youth Forum, but that was in 1998. So that's a little while ago. And I think that time we had the meeting up in Prabhupada's rooms. Yeah. This is where you all normally gather?
No, because of this construction.
Okay, so temporary. Good. I'm just waiting for my computer to boot up here. What we're going to do tonight is I'm going to speak a little bit from a seminar that I've been teaching for the last couple of years called Srila Prabhupada, The Living Bhagavatam. I was fortunate enough to travel with Srila Prabhupada from the end of 1975 up until about March of 1977, so about a year and a half. And during that period I was keeping a diary. And later on, what I did was I took that diary and I got copies of all the recorded material that we recorded from morning walks and lectures, conversations. And then also I got copies of all the Prabhupada's correspondence. And I started to produce a book series called Transcendental Diary. Some of those books actually are down there in the bookstore in the temple room there, I saw up on the top shelf. So that is a daily account of Srila Prabhupada's activities from late 1975, and it will eventually, there's 5 volumes that have been published so far. There'll be another 2 volumes and that will complete it up to March of 1977. So what I did was, for this seminar, The Living Bhagavatam, I took different topics, chanting, prasadam, cleanliness, health, book writing, deities, like that. And each topic, then I compiled all the different things that Prabhupada said or did in relationship to that topic. And, of course, this is by no means, you know, a presentation of everything Prabhupada ever said on those topics. That would be a very difficult task, and it would run into about 50 volumes per topic. But what this is a concentrated and very focused look at these particular topics, and all the material is taken from that period that I was personally traveling with Srila Prabhupada, with one or two exceptions. So I thought tonight it would be nice we could talk a little bit about the topic of chanting. Because, of course, chanting is the whole basis of the Hare Krishna movement. And it was on the basis of Srila Prabhupada's chanting the Hare Krishna mantra that the Krishna consciousness movement was able to spread all over the world and become the huge organization that it is now, ISKCON, the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. So, I don't know how long we go for. How long do we go? What, 1 hour or something? Yeah? 1 hour? Alright, so I'll talk a little, I'll read a little bit. If anybody has any questions as we go along, feel free to put your hand up and you can ask, and we'll try to satisfy your curiosity and inquisitiveness. Okay? Sounds good. Alright, so this on the topic of chanting then. This is something that I heard actually after Prabhupada's disappearance. That's too loud. It's booming. It's too loud. Just down a little bit. It was okay where it was. That's good. Everybody can hear okay?
Yes.
So this was a conversation. I didn't hear it directly, but somebody told it to me. but it's very illustrative of Srila Prabhupada's potency for chanting the holy names. It was a conversation between two of Prabhupada's god brothers. One of them was Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji Maharaj. He was a very interesting personality. I think he was the only person that was initiated by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, who was given as his only service the chanting of the holy names. Everybody else was engaged in active preaching work, but this particular man, Krishna, he was also given Babaji initiation. He was allowed by Srila Bhaktisiddhanta to just simply chant. So, if anybody had an appreciation of chanting, then Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji Maharaj would have that. He was always very bright, jolly kind of person. He would come and see Prabhupada sometimes, especially when we were in Vrindavan. And the holy name was always on his tongue. Even in between sentences, he would chant, Hare Krishna, like this. If he said something and you replied, he would be chanting as you reply. So, he was having a conversation with another god brother of Srila Prabhupada's, Bon Maharaj. Bon Maharaj, of course, was well known for being one of the first disciples of Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati to be sent to try to start the preaching work in the Western countries. He went to England with, I think, Shravan Maharaj and a couple of others. And they stayed for some years there trying to get something going. This was in the 1930s. But they came back with not much result. And it was a disappointment, actually, for Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. Anyway, so sometime after our Srila Prabhupada's disappearance, these two god brothers were talking. And Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji was asking Bon Maharaj, he told him that, what's the difference between you and Swami Maharaj? He said, you're a scholar. He was also a scholar. You speak fluent English. He also speaks fluent English. You went to the West. He went to the West. He was successful and you were not. Why? And then he answered his own question. He said, because he had great faith in the holy names. So without commenting on Bon Maharaj, but Prabhupada, he recognized, had all of his success because of this tremendous faith that he had in the chanting of the holy names. He simply depended on Krishna, and that was it. So he was appreciating that. And there was another god brother that also appreciated the work that Srila Prabhupada was doing. On March the 15th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Mayapur, and he received a visit from his god brother, Srila B.R. Sridhar Swami. So Prabhupada sent his car over to Sridhar Maharaj's mutt, which was in Navadvip, and brought him over for the afternoon. So when he arrived, then they took prasadam together, and then afterwards they had rest, and then they got together for a couple of hours in Prabhupada's room and began talking. And Prabhupada was telling Sridhar Maharaj about so much of the preaching that was going on around the world, how many temples and how many devotees were coming, how many books that he was producing and distributing, like this. So then after a couple of hours, then Sridhar Maharaj went back to Navadvip. I went into Prabhupada's room, and Prabhupada told me, he said that Sridhar Maharaj had told him that actually you are the real Acharya. He said this verse, Prativita Chajato Nagaradi Gram, Sabracha Pracha Hoibe Moranam. He said, actually, we were thinking that this is some poetic expression, that the holy name will go all over the world. but we never actually believed it literally. He said, but now, because of you, you have done this actually. So we can understand the real import of this verse, that the chanting of the holy names will go all over the world. And therefore, I think that you are the real Acharya. Of course, that was a comment on the state of the Gaudiya Mat also, the organization of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, that it went from being a very powerful, united preaching force into a completely fragmented and disjointed conglomeration of individual mutts and individual acharyas. And immediately after Srila Bhaktisiddhanta left, there was a fight between several leading god brothers as to who would be the next acharya. And eventually in the court, then one of the god brothers, he was declared by court order that you are the acharya. So Sridhar Maharaj, he was telling, therefore Prabhupada, he was appreciating that actually you're the real acharya, because you're the one who's actually spread the holy name all over the world, and you have fulfilled this prediction of Lord Chaitanya. So that was nice. That was a couple of appreciations at least. Not all of Prabhupada's god brothers were appreciating what he did. Many of them, Prabhupada said, were envious of the success that he had, and you know, were reluctant to give him any help or even a few words of praise or recognition. But of course Prabhupada wasn't depending on them. He was just depending on Krishna for everything. And we see that before Prabhupada left, actually, he left on, it's interesting, he left on Friday the 13th in October of September of 1965. And August, sorry, he left in August on Friday the 13th. And the day before he left, Prabhupada had travelled to Mayapur, and he went to visit the Samadhi Mandir of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta, and he went there to pay his respects to his Guru Maharaj and get his blessings for his attempt to go out and preach in the foreign country. So then he returned the same day to Calcutta, and then the next day he set sail on the Jaladuta. So when Prabhupada left India for the first time, he printed up a small leaflet, and it was something to hand out to people explaining his mission. So in 1976, in August actually, so this was like 11 years later, Prabhupada was in New Mayapur in France, and one of the devotees had found a copy of this original leaflet that Prabhupada had printed up that he took with him when he went to the West, and he came and he showed that to Srila Prabhupada. So Prabhupada was curious to see it, and he asked me to read it out to him. His picture was on the front with the title reading Srimad Bhagavatam, India's Message of Peace and Goodwill, 60 volumes of elaborate English translation by Tridandi Goswami, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami. Because Prabhupada at that time had 3 volumes out, but this was his advertising that he was going to do 60 volumes of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Very ambitious. Carried by the Sindhya Steam Navigation Company Limited, Bombay, all over the world for scientific knowledge of God. So that was the heading. And while Prabhupada relaxed behind his desk, I read out the body of the text to him. I said, it says, the sufferings of the entire human society can at once be brought under control simply by individual practice of bhakti yoga, a simple and easy process of chanting the holy names of God. Every country, every nation, every community throughout the world has some conception of the holy name of God. And as such, either the Hindus or the Mohammedans or the Christians, everyone can easily chant the holy name of God in a meditative mood and that will bring about the required peace and goodwill in the present problematic human society. Any inquiry in this connection will be gladly answered by Sri Swamiji. The Hindus generally chant the holy name of God in 16 chain of transcendental sound composed of 32 alphabets as Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The Vedic literatures like the Upanishads and the Puranas recommend chanting the above mentioned 16 holy names at a stretch. And Lord Sri Chaitanya, whose cult of chanting the holy name of God gave special importance on these transcendental sounds. In this age of Kali, or the age of hate, hypocrisy, corruption, and quarrel, the only remedial measure is that every man should chant the holy name of the Lord, both individually and collectively. Then the rest of the pamphlet went on to give the English translation of the 8 prayers written by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in glorification of the holy name. It then ended with some highly complimentary reviews of Prabhupada's translation of the Srimad Bhagavatam. So that was Prabhupada's declaration. He was going to the West with one intention, and that was to introduce the chanting of the Hare Krishna Ma Mantra. And actually, again, whilst we were in New Mayapur on August the 2nd, then myself and another devotee, Hari Kesh, we were having just a little chat with Prabhupada in his room. And Prabhupada was recalling an incident between him and his godbrother, Bon Maharaj. This was maybe in 64 or 65, before Prabhupada went to the West. And Bon Maharaj was having some kind of utsav, some festival. So Prabhupada had been invited, and he was telling us about this, so he was laughing. He was saying, our Bon Maharaj, once I was eating at his festival. So he's a Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva means big Westerner. Yeah? So he said, so he has given everyone a knife and fork. So I did not know. I did not remember even which way I took this fork. So then Bon Maharaj began to criticize. Oh, you are going to a foreign country and you do not know which hand to take this fork and knife? So I told him, I am not going to learn all these things. I am going there to teach them something else, to forget it. You went to learn all these things, but I am not going to learn anything. So even before Prabhupada went, he was very clear about what he was going to the West for. And that was to chant Hare Krishna, not to become a Bodhisattva. So, on June 21st, 1976, Prabhupada was flying. He flew into Pittsburgh Airport, and from there, he was received by Kirtanananda Swami and taken on a 90-minute ride to New Vrindavan. New Vrindavan is in West Virginia. And of course, that was the first rural farming project, ashram, that we had in ISKCON. So the ride was comfortable, and as we progressed smoothly along the highway, Prabhupada kept up a running conversation. He reflected on the fallen condition of modern man, telling Kirtanananda Maharaj about his comparison of how the dog is running on 4 legs and man is running on 4 wheels. Same thing, same business, but the dog is running on 4 legs and man is running on 4 wheels. But the same thing is going on. He said that the only way to save them was to start with the basics, and then after some time, when they become a little purified, then give them some philosophy. He reminded Kirtanananda that this had been his policy right from the very beginning. He said, you have all got this experience. This is the only way. I started this movement on this determination that I will give them some prasadam, some nice chanting. They will not come. They must come. So this was my determination. And I began with this. So this is the only way. So give them a chance. No talk. Please come. Chant and dance and take Krishna prasadam and go home. No talking. Just eat, dance, sing and go home. That was Prabhupada's program. Kirtananda reflected that it was just 10 years ago since he had first met Srila Prabhupada. So this was, we were having this conversation in June of 76, and Kirtananda had met Srila Prabhupada in New York in June of 66. Prabhupada gave one of his endearing little sideways nods of assent. Yes, he said, I never said that, oh, you have to give up this, you have to do that. Never said. Then gradually, chaito darpana marjanam. When the heart becomes cleansed, then a little. So there is no hopelessness. So that was Prabhupada's program. Just let them chant and eat prasadam and go home. And gradually, when they become a little purified, then speak some philosophy. And of course, that was wonderfully successful. So again, on December the 8th, 1975, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan and he was giving a Bhagavatam class. So during that class he was recalling some of those early days in New York. So he was telling us how in New York his neighbors would protest at the morning chanting. He said, in the beginning, in that 26th Second Avenue, when our morning prayer was going on at 7 o'clock, not very early, and then so many other tenants in the building, same building, half naked, they would complain to the landlord. Oh, Mr. Judah, what is going on? What is going on? Stop it. Stop it. Stop. So Mr. Judah, he used to say, no, no, they'll not stop. I cannot say. You have to go to the police. So sometimes the police were coming to stop us, but we did not stop. So Prabhupada was laughing when he was telling us this. And of course all the devotees were laughing along with him. So Prabhupada was just very determined. Although he appeared to be this very simple, humble sadhu, you know, from India. But he had a very, very fixed determination what he was going to do. And he didn't care for anybody. No deference to the police or the neighbors or the landlord. He was going to go on with his program of chanting. And of course, because he had that determination, that gave all the devotees the same kind of determination. And an example of this, actually, I personally experienced when I joined the movement that was in Sydney in 1972, just at the beginning of 1972. So the movement there was going through a very dramatic growth. We actually, when I joined the temple in Sydney, there were about 10 or 12 devotees, and that was for the whole country. By the time Prabhupada came 6 weeks later, there were 45 devotees living in the temple. And practically speaking, we would go out, we would chant on the street for about 6 hours every day. That was our main activity. We would do our morning program at the temple, have breakfast. Then we had a double-decker bus. All the devotees would get on the bus. We would drive downtown Sydney. We'd get off. And then we would stand on a street corner. And we would just chant for 4, 5, 6 hours at a time. And then one or two devotees were selling Back to Godhead magazines. So when there were only a few devotees, it wasn't so difficult. But then when we had this very rapid expansion, and, you know, within a few months, we had 40 devotees, 50 devotees. So then that, of course, created some problems for us. Because when you have about 40, you know, devotees standing on the same street corner for 6 hours a day, all the office workers that are in that vicinity, they were getting very disturbed. So they started calling the police on us. So we used to, we would line up in front of one of the big shopping stores, like Woolworths or some other place. And there'd be 20 or 30 of us, all chanting. And then we would see all of a sudden, after about 10 or 15 minutes, then a p- police wagon, not a car, but a big van. It would come all of a sudden, it would appear around the corner, and then they would zoom up and stop right in front of us. And then all the police would jump out. And then all the devotees, we would all run. And we'd run all over. Everybody would be running. We'd run through all the department stores, running through the traffic. And the police would be running after us, trying to capture us. So this was going on practically every day for a while. And usually, whoever was playing the mridanga, they were the ones that got caught. Everybody else could run fast. So one or two would get captured, and then they would get booked at the police station, and then we'd have to go and get them out. So it became a regular feature. Then it got to the point where we were getting harassed so much that we decided not to do the big parties anymore. So we started having just two devotees on every street corner. So every crossroads in the city, there'd be two devotees. One would be chanting with kartals, and the other one would be selling back to Godhead. And then we would switch back and forth like that. That also became a problem, because there were so many of us on so many street corners. So anybody that was going along, he'd go from one street corner to the next, and he'd be approached to buy a magazine. So again, there were so many complaints. So eventually the municipality, they have their own offices, parking offices and people like this. So then they would come out, and every day they would take our photographs, and they would issue a ticket like this, and they'd take everybody's names. And they started to build up a legal case against us. So in that way then, the temple president in Sydney at that time, his name was Chirudas. So he wrote to Srila Prabhupada explaining now they're going to bring this big case against us and have us banned from going out on the street chanting and selling our books. So we need to get a lawyer. So he was writing, shall we get a lawyer? And it will cost, you know, $1,000. In those days that was a huge amount of money. Practically speaking, any individual devotee, like when I would go out and sell back to Godheads, in 6 hours I might sell 4 or 6 magazines, and we would get 20 cents or 40 cents like that. So I'd come back with $2 in a whole day. And the biggest distributors, they would collect maybe about $4 or $5. So to get $1,000 up to get a lawyer, you know, was a huge amount of money, and we would probably have to get a loan from the bank to be able to do that. So Chiru wasn't sure what to do, and he wrote to Srila Prabhupada explaining all the harassment and asking, you know, should we get this lawyer? So Prabhupada received that letter when he was in Dallas in Texas. And on the 10th of September in 1972, then he replied to Chiru. He said, please accept my blessings. I'm in due receipt of your letter, dated August the 31st, and I have noted the contents carefully. Now, regarding this business of Sankirtan, the solution is to simply go on with your Sankirtan activities as you have been doing, and let them arrest us if they like. We will not stop. Just like in London, they became arrested so many times, and there was so much public display of arresting, that gradually the police stopped arresting. And now they have Sankirtan anywhere they like without any botheration. So if we take this case into court and spend so much money for big, big lawyers, and still if we do not win, then they will have the legal right to stop us. So better let us forget this business of lawyers and judges, and simply go on with our Sankirtan. This is the civil disobedience movement. Let them fill their jails with us again and again, but we will not stop our Sankirtan movement. Also, it may help if you get some public sympathy through publicizing our constant persecution in the newspaper journals. Gradually, the city officials and constabulary will become embarrassed to arrest us further and gradually we will be allowed to go on with our sankirtan unhampered. But I do not think this business of expensive lawyers and going to court will solve anything. Better to simply be determined to hold our sankirtan in our own manner as we like and simply depend upon Krishna and his protection at all times. And then Prabhupada signed that, "Your ever well wisher." And then in his own hand, because that was typed up, at the bottom Prabhupada put a postscript. And he said, "There is no difference between our chanting on the street or in the temple or in the jail. A Krishna conscious person is not afraid of any place, but he wants to chant constantly in all circumstances." So actually we followed Prabhupada's advice. We forgot about the lawyers. We just kept on going out every day, chanting and doing our sankirtan activities. Then eventually, after I think about a year or a year and a half, the council actually brought the case to court. And they had a number of devotees as defendants. But we never bothered going there. I don't think we even knew it was going on. So they brought this big case against us to get us banned, and we were just going out chanting as usual. We didn't even bother going to the court. And they lost. So they spent many thousands of dollars bringing this big case against us, and then they lost. So Prabhupada was very happy that we were victorious. And we were very happy because we just depended on Prabhupada's advice and the holy names. And we came out triumphant. So a couple of years later, when I was with Prabhupada in Mayapur in February of 76, then this came up in discussion about this Sydney court case. So I was telling Prabhupada that in Sydney, they spent $10,000, the council, compiling a case against us. Every day they used to come and film us and take our names. Because when they were taking the devotees' names, they would say, "What's your name?" And one of the devotees would say, "Prasadam Das." And then, "What's your name?" "Samsara." Like that. So we give them all these bogus names. So every day they would come and film us and take names. And we didn't contest the case, but we just carried on with our sankirtan, and the judge threw them out of court. They spent $10,000. It was a big scandal, actually, and they lost the case. And the judge said, "Why not let them go on the streets? They add a lot of color to the city." So that he liked us. That was his comment. But anyway, that was the determination that we got from Prabhupada. We saw that, you know, in 1966, in 26 Second Avenue, the police were coming. Prabhupada wouldn't stop. And we repeated the same formula wherever we went. We'd go to a new city, we'd go on the streets and start chanting. We'd get arrested, we'd go out again and keep on chanting, and eventually they would realize that we weren't going to stop, and then they'd just give up and we would just carry on. So that was actually how the movement spread in many, many cities in the West. So, again, we had another conversation about where this court case, Sydney court case, came up. This was on November the 2nd in 1976. Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. And we were talking about the spread of the movement. And Prabhupada had received a report from Balavanta Prabhu, who at that time was the GBC in Southeast America, Atlanta and Florida and those areas. And one man apparently, I think maybe in Houston, he was some kind of a member of the legislative assembly, something like that. Some lawmaker anyway. He had gone on the TV and he had made a comment that this Hare Krishna cult is spreading so fast, it's like an epidemic. And if we don't stop them, they'll take over the government within 10 years. Like this. So he was speaking on the TV. So that was reported to Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was very happy when he heard that comment. So he was telling us now on November 76, he said, no, that is their feeling. that the Krishna consciousness movement is spreading so fast, like an epidemic, that we must take some steps. And then he was saying to myself, and you said that in Australia, there was one man there that said that if the people take to this movement, then where will they stand? What was that you said? So then I explained. It was something I'd read in the newspaper. After that court case, then the newspapers had gone to a psychologist, to ask, why is there so much reaction against just a few people, you know, singing and dancing in the street? So I told Prabhupada, there was a psychiatrist, he said, that the Sydney City Council are trying to have us banned from the city altogether. And they took us to court, and we didn't contest the case, and they lost. And then afterwards they worked out that they spent $10,000 and so much manpower to try to get rid of us, and it didn't work. So one newspaper man, he went to a psychiatrist, and he asked him, can you explain why this huge reaction against just a few people singing and dancing in the street? So the man replied, well, basically, it is because the city dwellers feel very threatened by their simple lifestyle. So Prabhupada said, yes, just see. So this whole Western civilization is threatened. So he was very happy that his Krishna consciousness movement was having such a strong impact. He said many times that if we had been something insignificant, then nobody would bother with us. Yeah, nobody says anything, then it means you have no importance. But if you have some strength, then immediately you'll get some reaction. So he always took it that it was a very good thing that there was so much reaction to try to stop us. He said that means that we have some importance and there's some weight to this movement. So that's just a few things about, you know, Prabhupada's intent when he set up ISKCON and how everything in the movement was based on this principle of chanting Hare Krishna, and that was the basis for the success of the whole movement. So now, of course, there's different kinds of chanting. There's japa and there's kirtan, two main kinds. One is that we do for ourselves, and the other kind, of course, we do for the public. So we'll talk a little bit about chanting japa. That's very important. Prabhupada also gave a lot of stress, not just on street sankirtan, but on this business of chanting our rounds every day. So when we were, let's see, what have we got here? One question that I get asked a lot, in fact somebody just asked me about 3 days ago, is how many rounds did Srila Prabhupada chant? And I actually never asked Prabhupada how many rounds he was chanting. There's varying opinions, but I can say that he was at least chanting 16 rounds, if not more. Now, it has been said that in the Gaudiya Math that the devotees there were advised to chant 64 rounds a day. But from what I understand, that was not like a fixed up standard. It was not that everybody was chanting 64 rounds. It depended on their situations. But there is a recollection that Shruta Kirti Prabhu, who was Prabhupada's servant for about 2 years before I became his servant, he recollects, he has compiled some of his remembrances about the times that he was with Prabhupada. That's not published, but it's on electronic format. And it's entitled Srila Prabhupada Uvacha, Prabhupada said. And there's about 130 different little anecdotes that Shruti Kirti relates. So one of them, number 62, he recalls, he said that it was easy to understand that Prabhupada enjoyed chanting japa. He always stressed the importance of our chanting our 16 rounds. He once told me that as a householder, he had used a simple process for completing 16 rounds that we could also apply. When I was a householder, he said, I would chant 4 rounds before each meal and 4 rounds before retiring in the evening. So 3 meals a day. That's 12 rounds, and then 4 at the end. In this way, 16 rounds could be chanted without difficulty. He laughed and he said, if you don't take prasadam until you finish chanting your 4 rounds, then you'll be sure to get them chanted. Because nobody misses their prasadam, of course. So if you vow, I have to chant 4 rounds before I eat, you'll always get your rounds done. So anyway, that was something that Prabhupada told Shruta Kirti. There was also a recollection by one of Prabhupada's godbrothers, Nayananda Das Babaji Maharaj. He just died a couple of years ago, actually. He was a very old man. But he was interviewed by one of our god sisters, Mula Prakriti Dasi. And he says that, as far as I understood, Sri Abhay Charanaravinda Prabhu, right from the very first time that he met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, and especially later, was keeping the highest standards. Even though he had not requested formal initiation, we saw that he was chanting 64 rounds a day. This was during all the time that he was working full-time in his business. Whenever we met him, he was daily chanting and counting 1 lakh of names. When we got time off from work, he would immediately go and associate with the different devotees of the Gaudiya Mat. He would go to Bagh Bazaar, or he would also go by train to Navadweep and Mayapur. So how accurate that is, it's hard to say. Of course, without having Prabhupada here to ask. But at least at some point, we can assume that Prabhupada was chanting 64 rounds a day. Although he mentions that he would go to Bagh Bazaar temple, which is in Calcutta, and also to Navadweep. We know that Prabhupada was living in Allahabad for many years throughout the 40s, and he didn't return to Calcutta until the late 40s. So it may be that this devotee observed Prabhupada, you know, in those later stages. But at any rate, we know that Prabhupada said he was chanting at least 16 rounds when he was a householder, and possibly more than that. But from my observation, Prabhupada was doing at least 16, and probably more, because many of the times, if there was a little break in the day, no visitors, then Prabhupada would sit very quietly, and he liked to just chant japa. So he was definitely at least chanting a fixed number, and he confirmed that one time when we were in Toronto in 1976. This was on June the 18th, and Prabhupada was receiving some professors from the local university, Joseph O'Connell, I think, and a couple of others. So one of the professors asked Srila Prabhupada how long it had taken him to complete the writing of the Chaitanya Charitamrita, and he especially was wondering when he found the time to write. So Prabhupada told him that it took him a year and a half to complete the 17 volumes. 1.5 years, 17 volumes. Apart from that, he was still working on the Bhagavatam and so many other things. And then he explained his schedule. He said, I write in the night. I go to bed at 10:30. I get up at 12:30. Then I finish my chanting, if there is any balance. And then I begin my dictating. So there's a direct statement from Prabhupada that he was chanting a fixed number, because he finished his balance of rounds, if there was any, before he started doing his translation work in the middle of the night. So, of course, now the question, there was always sometimes some question about the practice of chanting 16 rounds, and why that particular number. So, on a morning walk in December of 1975, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. This was December the 11th. And Akshayananda Swami, who was the temple president in Vrindavan at that time, he asked Prabhupada if there was any Shastric verification for our standards of chanting japa, which he said some people have found fault with. So there were some who in other mats that were criticizing, oh, you're only chanting 16 rounds. Some of the local Babaji's were also saying like that. So Akhayananda, he said, of course we accept that when you tell us to chant 16 rounds, we accept that figure in perfect faith. You are the Acharya. But what if we want to convince others? Is there any Shastric or Vedic verse that we can refer to corroborate that we must chant at least 16 rounds or that many number of names? Prabhupada replied, no, he said, in the Shastra it is not said like that. It is said, Sankhya Purvaka, you must fix up the numerical strength. So whatever you can do, but I have fixed up 16 rounds because you cannot do. Means you can't do more than that. So Akshayananda Swami confirmed, that's all we can do. Prabhupada smiled and he added with a touch of irony, yes, and that also difficult. So Akshayananda Swami laughed, yes. And Prabhupada continued, otherwise, Haridas Thakur, he was chanting 3 lakhs. So that is not possible, and you should not imitate. But whatever you fix up, that you must do, and that is wanted. Yes, Akshayananda said, I was told that in the beginning, you asked the first disciples to chant 64 rounds. Prabhupada said, yes. And they were unable, Akshayananda said. And with us all laughing, he said, then you asked them to chant 32? Prabhupada grinned. Sankhya Purvaka Nama Gana Nati B. Sankhya Purvaka, or numerical strength, must be there. And you should follow rigidly. So Akshayananda said, so if we are serious and sincere, that means that 16 rounds will increase to continuously chanting. That you can do now, Prabhupada said. It is not that because I have finished 16 rounds, you can increase. But that 16 must be finished. Yes, Akshayananda said. What I mean to say is that is to bring us to the platform of chanting constantly. At least we must do that numerical number. And if we are fortunate, we may be finally able to chant constantly day and night. Yes, Prabhupada confirmed. So he made a reference there to the early days again in New York when Prabhupada first introduced the chanting of japa. And I once asked Brahmananda, who of course also joined in 26 Second Avenue right at the very beginning, about, you know, Prabhupada changing the number of rounds. Because apparently what he did was he asked the devotees to chant 64. And then after a day or two, they all came back and they said, Swamiji, this is too much, we just can't do it. So then Prabhupada said, all right, 32. So then after a couple of days, they came back again, they said, Swamiji, this is just too much, we just can't do this. So then Prabhupada said, all right, 16, but not less. And Prabhupada never changed from that 16. He established that as the standard. So I once discussed this with Brahmananda. And Brahmananda told me that he had actually asked Srila Prabhupada why he had done that, why he had, you know, changed it. And then Prabhupada told him, he said, I was experimenting. So he was seeing what the Westerners were capable of doing. And he saw that they're not going to be able to chant all day, every day. So give them some practical engagements and then some minimum number that they have to chant. And this way Prabhupada gradually evolved our ISKCON sadhana, this morning program. As he gradually introduced deity worship, then Mangalarati came in, and then, you know, we chant our japa 16 rounds, then we have greeting of the deities, we have then the Bhagavatam class. So in that way then Prabhupada, you know, told us 2 hours chanting, 2 hours hearing like this, and then the rest of the day you go out, sell books, and do practical preaching work. So Prabhupada also confirmed that, actually. This was on September 17, 1976. He was in Vrindavan. He was giving a class again. And he told us that chanting a certain fixed number of rounds every day is one of the rules governing success. He said that Haridas Thakur had chanted 3 lakhs of names per day, but Rupa Goswami had chanted less because he was writing books, although he still did a fixed number of rounds. Similarly, Prabhupada said, we must have some numerical strength, and we have minimized. I know that you were coming from a different source, so according to time, according to circumstances. But even then, there is no limit. You can chant more than 1600 names, but practically, we see that even chanting 16 rounds becomes difficult. So, don't try to imitate, but do it properly, what is advised by your spiritual master, without any offense. That mantra will save you from the dangers of Maya. That is a fact. So even with people that were not initiated, Prabhupada stuck to that 16-round standard. There was one incident when we were in Los Angeles in June of 76, June the 6th, and Prabhupada had received one guest. He was a famous tennis player. Now he's retired. His name's Peter Burwash. He was a professional tennis player, and he had a tennis coaching organization. So in all big hotels all over the world, you could go there. There would be Peter Burwash International. There would be a resident tennis coach. And any guest in the hotel, they could pay to have lessons from a professional tennis coach. So that was his organization. So he came, he was a devotee actually. And he came to visit Prabhupada in Los Angeles. So he told Prabhupada that the men that he signs up on his staff to be coaches must follow the 4 regulative principles. And if they break them, they are released and they cannot rejoin. This is actually written into their contracts. They try to preach, although not too directly. And if someone shows a favorable attitude, then they try to nurture that. A few of them, who are tuned into the more spiritual side of things, are gradually introduced to the philosophy if they show some inclination. He said that the biggest difficulty is the long hours that they work. A regimen of 16 or 18 hour work days makes it difficult for them to chant 16 rounds a day. So he asked Prabhupada if it was all right to chant only 8 or 10 rounds. Prabhupada appreciated their sincerity and he was very friendly to them, but he held firm to his standard of 16. So the meeting was very congenial. Prabhupada thanked them for their efforts and encouraged them to continue. So he wouldn't budge off that 16-round standard, even though this were just some professional tennis players. But he said, no, you have to chant 16 rounds. That's the standard. Actually, I think Peter was chanting 8 rounds, and he always did that. Even afterwards, he was still chanting 8 rounds. But now I think he's increased to 16. I see him sometimes. He comes to our Vrindavan temple there. Very nice man. So, again, that's 16 rounds. April the 1st, 1976, Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. And he was talking on Srimad Bhagavatam 7.9.46, where Prahlad Maharaj is speaking about the vow of Mona, or silence. In India, even today, people sometimes practice Mona, although generally it is not done for spiritual purposes. Neither is it strictly followed, because the practitioner often communicates with a small blackboard and chalk, or a pencil and paper. Therefore, Prabhupada said, there is no question of not talking. One must talk. But that talk should only be about Krishna. If all we talk about is mundane activities, he told us, then we should practice Mona. But for one who is preaching Krishna consciousness, there is never enough to be said. He told us, Srila Rupa Goswami says, I have only got one tongue and 2 ears. So how can I enjoy or serve Hare Krishna with only one tongue and 2 ears? If I had millions of ears and trillions of tongues, then it would be possible. So he's feeling like that. He is expecting so many ears and so many tongues to chant the Hare Krishna mantra. Then he added, with perhaps a touch of irony, a comment relating to our present state of affairs. He said, so far we are concerned, conditioned souls, even 16 rounds becomes very, very difficult because we are practiced to talk all nonsense. We cannot find out a little time, say for 2 hours, for chanting Hare Krishna, but we can find out 24 hours for talking all nonsense. Therefore, one who cannot chant the Hare Krishna mantra, he should stop his talking. That is called mona. Don't talk anymore. You better remain silent. So this is recommended by Prahlad Maharaj. So he concluded the class by saying that nowadays, no one can follow the strict practices mentioned in the scriptures. Therefore, we should simply rely on the mercy of Lord Chaitanya and chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. So, we've been going for an hour. This seminar actually takes about 6 or 7 hours to complete. So we're not going to get anywhere near the end tonight. So, it's already 9:10. Does anybody have any questions? When did I join ISKCON? I shaved my head on St. Valentine's Day in 1972. I remember it very specifically. I gave up all my other Valentines and I took Krishna as my Valentine. So that was in Sydney. I was born and brought up in England and I emigrated in 1971 to Australia. Inspiration,
yeah,
to join. Well, at that time when I left England I was 20 years old because I just left school. I wasn't interested in pursuing a university education because I'd already figured out that whatever I was learning at school was a useless waste of time, so I wasn't particularly happy about going to school. I had a job for a couple of years, then I got fed up with that. And basically I was just very dissatisfied with, the way that my life was unfolding. Because when you're 18 or 19 or 20 years old, you're coming to that stage of leaving school, you're thinking about what you're going to do with the rest of your life, you're just becoming a little independent. You're faced with leaving home, going and getting your own place, all these things. So it naturally makes you think about what you're going to do with the rest of your life. And I didn't know. What I did know was that I wasn't happy. And I had a job for a couple of years, and then I decided to pack it in because I wasn't happy with it. One of my brother's friends, he used to work with me, he came up and he got very angry that you have a good job and now you're giving it up. Why are you giving it up? You're very foolish. You'll never get another chance like this, blah, blah, blah. I just told him, I said, I'm not happy. So I said, if I'm not happy, then why should I do it? So, I'm just going to go out and see if I can find something that makes me happy. So he said, well, what happens if you don't find something that makes you happy? It's like Krishna and Arjuna, right? Arjuna asks, if I give up material life and then I'm not successful spiritually, then what happens? I'll be like a rent cloud. So my reply, because I'd never heard of the devotees or even spiritual life at that point, I was totally in ignorance. But anyway, I told him, I said, well, at least I'll have the satisfaction of knowing that I tried. Then he told me, he said, well, that's not my philosophy. He said, my philosophy is that you get a good job and you make yourself happy with the job. And I thought, well, you're a moodhar. Not moodhar, I didn't use that word, but something a little stronger. So anyway, I gave that up. And I was, looking. I was dissatisfied. I made the decision to leave England. and, you know, go someplace else and see what was happening in some other part of the world. So I went with some friends to Australia. Around about that time, I had a couple of little experiences that were unusual. I had an out-of-body experience and a couple of other little things that happened. And that basically made me realize that there was other levels of reality that, you know, I was not aware of. And it was a little bit like waking up. So somehow or another, anyway, I started becoming interested in reincarnation and yoga and like this, these things. Then we went to Australia in 71. When we landed in Sydney, the first day that we were off the boat and in the city, just looking around, we walked into the devotees. And I was immediately, was attracted by them. I didn't know what on earth they were doing, but I was just attracted. And I could see that they were completely different from everybody else. You know, they were there in the middle of the city, but they were not part of the city scene. And one of the devotees sold me a BTG. So I took that, and then we went off. We went up in some mining camp for about 6 months because we had no money. So I had to earn some money. That kind of took me way away from the mainstream society. We were living on a mining camp. And every now and again I'd take out this Back to Godhead and I'd read it. And every time I read it, it would make a little bit more sense. So then eventually I got to the point after 6 months that I thought, I have to go and, you know, find these people again and find out more about what this is. Because by that point, it was the only thing that was making any sense to me at all was what Prabhupada was saying in the Back to Godhead. Although I hadn't fully realized what he was talking about at that point. But so anyway, there was some kind of, you know, inner turmoil and looking for something different, asking a lot of questions. And especially I got to a point where I had this one question that I couldn't answer, and that was, what is God? And I had been in my youth an atheist. I used to enjoy debating with my mother and disproving the existence of God. You know, she had some faith, and I would get on a case and tell her this is just nonsense and like this. But then later on I came to the realization that actually you can't prove whether there's a God or not. So then I became an agnostic. That, well, I can't say for sure that there's no God, but I can't say for sure there is a God. Halfway between. Then I got the BTG. And then, anyway, there was a lot of things that I was attracted to. You know, the chanting and the different things Prabhupada was saying in the magazine. So I thought, I'll go back and I'll try and find these people. So I traveled back. I think I traveled about 3,000 miles from the northwest of Australia down to Perth and then across from Perth to Sydney. It's a long way. And I met the devotees on the way to Sydney. They'd moved by that time. They'd started a center in Melbourne. And I was very happy to see them. They were out chanting and selling magazines. And they had a couple of more issues of Back to Godhead. And so I went up to one of the devotees. And I actually asked him, have you got anything there that tells you what is God? So he was naturally very happy that I asked him. And to his credit, he had actually read everything in the magazines. And he immediately opened up one of the BTGs and he read out a paragraph. And it was Prabhupada speaking in some lecture and he was giving a description of God. And he said, God is omniscient. God is omnipotent. And God is omnipresent. And God is a person. And his name is Krishna. like that. So he read this out to me, and I thought, oh, okay, I'll read that again. So I kept my finger in the page. And I was due to catch a train in about 2 or 3 hours to go from Melbourne to Sydney. So I took the magazine and I went off to the riverbank, which was just nearby, and I sat down and I started reading it. And then when I read it, I went straight to that description again. And then as I read it, then it was, I suppose you could call it, was a moment of revelation. As I read each description, God is omnipotent, all-powerful, I got a sudden realization of what that actually meant. It was like a light bulb, literally like a light bulb going off in my head. And then God is omnipresent, and like that, and God is omniscient. And then when I read, and God is a person, that was it. It clicked. Then I finally, because every time I was trying to think, you know, what is God, I get a complete blank. You know, that little three-letter word was the biggest annoyance in my life at that point, because I could not figure out, I couldn't get any grasp of that word God, what it actually meant. I had no idea, and it would annoy me like anything. Then when I read this, and Prabhupada said, and God is a person, then that was it. It just became crystal clear. I thought, of course, he has to be a person. And Prabhupada was the first person to say that. That was the... And then, you know, he said, and his name is Krishna. And then I thought, wow, this is really far out. He even knows his name. So then at that point, I actually understood that God exists, you know, clearly. And then I thought, well, this is it now. If this is actually true, if I accept that this is true, and God is everywhere, and He knows everything, and He's always present, then that means that everything is, you know, under His control. That means I'm under His control, and there's nothing that I can do that He doesn't know. So I have no choice. I have to surrender to Him. And I'd never been to a temple or anything. I didn't know about those things. I just bought that one magazine. That was it. But I just understood very clearly. If I accept that this is true, then if I'm going to be honest, I have to now live according to this truth. So that was it. I made up my mind. It's when I get to Sydney, I'm going to find this place where these people live. I'm going to join. And that's what I did. So, you know, it was a struggle for about a year, I remember. I went through a lot of very intense changes in my life, internal mainly. And I started disassociating with practically everything and everybody that I knew. And by Krishna's arrangement, because I left England where I've been brought up, I went to a new country where I didn't know anybody. So I was just separated immediately, you know, from all of my old material entanglements. So I got there and then immediately I met the devotees. So, I just saw it was Krishna's arrangement. And so I joined. And then just not long after that, then Prabhupada came. I joined in early February. I shaved up on St. Valentine's Day. And then Prabhupada came 6 weeks later for his second visit to Australia. And then I was initiated at that time. A brief life history. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that schedule, Prabhupada was saying that was when he was a householder, he had a business. So he couldn't live. He said, I was a householder, I couldn't live in the mutt. He used to go and visit all the time at the Allahabad temple. But he was, you know, he had a pharmacy, he had to travel a lot. He had a big area that he was the agent for. So, you know, obviously at some point he was keeping that schedule just to make sure that he got his rounds done every day. But when he set up ISKCON, of course, you know, he didn't advise us like that. He advised us that, you know, you get up early in the morning, do all your rounds early in the morning as much as possible, because that way, you know, it's very peaceful, your mind is very calm, you know, there's no distractions. And then after that, you can go out and do all your other work. Otherwise, if you have rounds left to do in the night time, then very often we're too tired, we've been out, you know, doing so many different things, and it's very hard to do good rounds. So, but the point is that, you know, it's flexible. If you need to adjust that schedule, then do so. But the main thing is to do your 16 rounds. You know, however you want to arrange it, whether you do 4-4-4-4, or like that, or whether you do all 16 in the morning, but do your 16 rounds. Yes. Yes, so why don't you become resident? Yeah, even if you're working, but you have to chant your rounds. Then if you do that, then you won't fall into Maya. That Prabhupada said, that's your protection against Maya. Yeah, because if you're working, especially if you're not working with devotees, then all day long you're exposed to, you know, mundane talk, mundane activities. Even people are friendly with you and they're nice, but because they think that they are their bodies and they think that you are your body, they'll relate to you both grossly and subtly as a body. And in order for you to relate back to them, you will have to relate to them as a body also. It's very easy to slip into that mentality. So automatically you get drawn into a very mundane frame of consciousness just by associating with people who think that they are their bodies. So that's not good. So if you chant your 16 rounds every day, that will help to keep your consciousness clear and aloof from that bodily entanglement. All right? Yeah. That's a good question. This came up with Prabhupada in April of 1976 when we were in Vrindavan. He's asking, where did the pastimes of Lord Nrisimhadev take place? Did they take place in Ahovalam? Or did they take place some other place, some other planetary system? And I actually have something on this, if I can find it. Maybe book writing. Let me just see. It might take me too long to find this. But anyway, in April of 76, Yashodhanandan Swami, who had been traveling in the south, he came to visit Prabhupada in Vrindavan. And he had some pictures of a Hovalam, which he wanted to do an article for Back to Godhead magazine. But then there was some controversy whether this was actually the place or not. And then it was pointed out that actually Hiranyakashipu had occupied the throne of Indra. So if he was in Indra's palace, when he was killed, then how could it be in Ahavalam? Because that's not Indraloka. So like that, there was some debate about the whole thing. So Prabhupada said, well, if there's some doubt, then we shouldn't print that in the Back to Godhead. But he said, anyway, it doesn't matter, because according to our prayers, Lord Nisringadev is everywhere. So he said, whether it's this place or that place, it doesn't matter. Lord Nisringadev is in all the places. So whether it's Ahavalam or, you know, some other place. And there's no harm if, just like we have New Vrindavan, there's the original Vrindavan and there's a New Vrindavan. So New Vrindavan is as good as the other Vrindavan, because the only activity there that goes on is Krishna conscious. So in the same way, whether Ahavalam is the actual site or whether it's a replica of the site, the pastime is celebrated there. So that's just as good. Well, as I say, I have something on that somewhere, but I can't. Let me see. Let me just see if I can find it. Any other questions whilst I'm looking? Yeah. Well, maybe they weren't such great saints.
But godbrothers of Prabhupada, they would be a great saint.
No, some of them were very elevated. But Prabhupada was very clear about the mistakes that they made. Because he said that in particular, the godbrother that fought for the position of being acharya, actually he said he was a very, you know, materialistic person. He was an expert manager, but he didn't have so much realization. So he took it as a business. So Prabhupada said he personally avoided him, dealing with him. And he didn't have a very high opinion of him. But there were other godbrothers who were advanced, but Prabhupada said their fault was that instead of forming a GBC, as Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati had instructed them to before he left, they also just, after when they saw these other godbrothers fighting, so then the other ones, they just went off on their own and started up their own temples. So he said what they should have done is they should have combined together, made a GBC, and then they could have defeated this cunning of this other godbrother. But instead they all just went off on their own because they all wanted to be acharya. He said that was the disease. So even if you're very advanced spiritually, there can be so many anattas that have to still be cleared. Yeah. Prabhupada said that the next acharya will be self-effulgent. Self-effulgent means he doesn't have to go to the court and have himself declared as an acharya. By his activities, everybody will know. So that may take a little time to see who's actually genuine and who's not. It's not by declaration, yeah, or appointment. But by one's own activities, then one becomes qualified. All right? Any other questions? Yes. Sorry, say that last one again.
The question is, Japan is possible?
Yeah.
At a very critical question. The question of us not being able to have a shaka is totally upset. He's situated at a remote forest. One side in life, one side in snake. And still he's jumping.
So what's your point there? What's your question?
The question is that the and he is in a very, very, very dangerous position.
Yeah.
If other everything has been done.
I'll read you one little story here. Since you've asked about, you know, somebody chanting japa and a snake or something, right? You're saying in a dangerous position. So what's your question? Is that how will he deal with that? Or should he just keep on chanting? Or what's your question?
Is it possible?
To keep on chanting. Let me just read you something here. Okay. This is about a devotee called Shyamadas. He had been in Africa. He was a black American devotee. He'd gone to Africa. But then the temples in Africa were a little disturbed. There was some nonsense going on. He got disturbed, so he left there in 75. And he came to see Prabhupada, I think around September of 75. And all he wanted to do was just chant. Didn't want to do any management, no preaching, nothing. Just chant. So Prabhupada could see that he was disturbed, so he said, all right, you know, you can... He wanted to go to Mayapur, so Prabhupada said, all right, go to Mayapur and just chant. So he went there. So then in 76, Prabhupada was in Mayapur, and this boy Sharma was still there. So then on February the 25th, in Mayapur, the conversation turned to Shyamadas, an American devotee who came here after serving in Africa. Disturbed by the misbehavior and poor standards there, he came to Vrindavan to see Prabhupada late last year, saying he only wanted to chant Hare Krishna. Prabhupada allowed him to come here to Mayapur. At present, he's living in the Goshala, chanting 150 rounds a day, and eating only the remnants of foodstuffs left by the devotees. Recently, he came to Prabhupada to get permission to build a tree hut to live in, so that he could avoid seeing anyone. He complained that he was being disturbed because devotees coming to see him interrupted his chanting. But Prabhupada condemned his idea, which he said was living like a monkey. He said Sharma's so-called renunciation was actually only another form of sense gratification. It was also based on selfish interest, even if it was only a small display of it. In other words, I don't want anything to do with anybody. Just want to chant. Just me. It's selfish. So, Prabhupada gave the example of two thieves. One who steals a diamond and the other who steals a cucumber. Prabhupada explained that simply because one steals in a small way, it does not mean that he is not a thief. So then Jaipataka Maharaj asked if Grihastha life was meant for one who steals cucumbers. Prabhupada laughed. He said, yes, Krishna is giving allowance for stealing the cucumber. Anyway, so Prabhupada conceded that Sharma was at least not doing anything bad. But he said that active service is better. Prabhupada was not displeased with him, as something is better than nothing. So he allowed him to stay here, because if he leaves, he may end up going elsewhere to practice something other than Krishna consciousness. So then a week later, on March the 8th, Shyamadas came from his hideaway at the Goshala at 4 o'clock to to see Srila Prabhupada with a request to leave Mayapur. Now he wants to go and chant at Radhakund. With so many devotees here now for the Gopunima festival, he complained that he is again being disturbed in his chanting. Prabhupada told him that this indicates that his mind is restless. Previously he had asked to live in a tree, and now Radhakund. He told him, "You are not fit for Nirjana Bhajan." Prabhupada told him, "This is for the Mahabhagwats, like Haridas Thakur, who were completely undisturbed." Haridas Thakur was living in a cave with a large snake, but he was not perturbed. He added that if one's mind is even a little disturbed, Nirjana Bhajan will not be possible. After this meeting, Shama Prabhu later told Pushtakrishna Swami that he had decided to return to Africa and preach. And Prabhupada was pleased to hear this. So he did actually go back to Africa. Then in September, he wrote Prabhupada a letter. This is about 6 months later. So, again, now he requested permission to make chanting his main service. He said he didn't want to act whimsically and that he only wanted to please Srila Prabhupada. He declared, "We have no love for Krishna, but we have this attraction to serve Krishna as a servant of the confidential serving maids of Krishna. By your mercy, we understand we cannot go to Vrindavan by any ticket. So we are, by the grace of Krishna, trying to fix our mind on this service in Vrindavan." It seems like he was trying to meditate on the activities of the gopis. "This fixing of the mind is dependent on my chanting Krishna's names, and my chanting Krishna names is simply dependent on your mercy, because my god brothers do not like me chanting. We do not want to commit offenses to our god brothers, yet sometimes when I tell them that I only want to chant, I only want to hear about Krishna in Vrindavan, or the glories of his holy name or qualities, some say we must talk of other things. They are more pure than my sinful self. As far as this living entity is concerned, he only wants to hear or talk about Krishna. My god brothers, as far as I am concerned, are better and more advanced, but because of my sinful condition, if you would allow me to chant these few extra rounds, read your books and render some small service, maybe before leaving this body, Krishna will allow this sinful living entity to be elevated to the position of one of his loving servants. It is our only desire to have our devotional kripa take shelter of Goloka Vrindavan and to somehow or another please our spiritual master and Krishna." So Prabhupada's reply to him was quite terse. "So, why did you leave Mayapur if you were so expert in chanting? Read my books and do some menial service. But why have you left Mayapur? You were restless, so what can be done? You were chanting in Mayapur, so wherever you may live, you have to abide by the order of the authority. Because you were restless, you were not fit for chanting absolutely." So that's very clear there, that you can get to that stage, yeah, where you're totally undisturbed. But it's a very, very advanced stage and it is not to be imitated. You have to be completely pure and on this stage of samadhi practically, like Haridas Thakur. Huge snake was living in his cave, he didn't even notice it. And then by Krishna's arrangement, that snake was inspired by the super soul within to leave the cave. Not because Haridas Thakur wanted it to leave, but the other devotees, when they were coming to see him, would be afraid to enter the cave because the snake was there. So just to pacify the other devotees, Krishna sent the snake away. But Haridas Thakur didn't care. Well, you are. It is
side, he is the malefactor. Then?
Yes. Anybody, any entity that hears the chanting of the Maha Mantra gets spiritual benefit. Even the non-moving living entities, the rocks, the trees, everything. When you chant the Hare Krishna Mantra, because it's Krishna himself, and Krishna is everything, everything is Krishna's energy. So when you invoke the holy name of Krishna, he's everywhere. Just like Prahlad Maharaj, he was challenged by Hiranyakashipu because he got very frustrated. He was trying to kill him and he couldn't kill him. And he was trying to figure out where this small boy is getting so much power from. Because I'm the most powerful living being in this universe and I can't kill him. I've tried so many ways and somehow or another, nothing happens. So he got very frustrated and angry with Prahlad. And he demanded to know, where is the source of your power? So he said, my source of power is the same as yours. So then he got more angry. Because he was thinking, I am, everything. And then Prahlad said, no, you get your power from the same source that I'm getting mine. That's Lord Vishnu. So then he got really angry and then he demanded to know, well, where is this? I don't see this Vishnu. Where is he? And then he said, well, he's everywhere. So he said, well, if he's everywhere, then, is he here in this pillar? So he said, yes. So he had full... Prahlad Maharaj was a Mahabhagwat. He saw everything in relation to the Lord. There was nothing that he saw that was not part of Krishna. So he understood Krishna is everywhere at every moment. And he can appear at any moment, from anywhere, through any source. Because it's all part of himself. So not difficult for Krishna to make an appearance anywhere, at any time. So, because Hiranyakashipu was a typical atheist. He couldn't see God. So then he took his sword, well, if he's in this pillar, then I'll show you what I'll do with him. And he smashed the pillar, and then of course Lord Nisringadev came out of the pillar and ripped into pieces. So the point is that when you chant the holy name, Krishna is already there everywhere. And when you invoke the holy name, it encourages Krishna to make his appearance. Therefore Prabhupada said that when a pure devotee chants, he does not need to invite others to chant with him. The whole world automatically chants with him. Wherever he goes, all he has to do is chant, and people automatically will begin to chant with him because they become affected. Because when a pure devotee chants, Krishna is personally present. He's fully manifest in the chanting of a pure devotee. He is his name. So a pure devotee doesn't have to ask people to chant along with him. They'll do it automatically. They become attracted. Because Krishna's in their heart. So anybody who's a little bit pious, a little bit, has a little bit of punya, then immediately they get attracted by the principles of devotional service. Because that's Krishna. He is present there. The mantra is both the means and the end. We chant Hare Krishna to get purified, but that's not the purpose of chanting Hare Krishna. That's a side effect. The purpose of chanting Hare Krishna is to chant Hare Krishna more. Because he is Krishna. He is the holy name. And that's the goal of devotional service, is to please Krishna, bow down before Krishna, think of Krishna, worship Krishna, and serve him. So a devotee is always engaged in service by chanting the holy names. Always. Does that answer your question? Any other questions? Okay, it's really late. I guess we went a little longer. 10 to 10. Okay, so we'll finish there. I'm going to speak at Chaupati tomorrow. If any of you are going to be there for the Sunday feast lecture, and that will be at And all of the material, that all these quotes that I've been giving here, these are all in one of the volumes, one or more of the volumes of that book that I've written, Transcendental Diary. This is all, as I say, anecdotes from when, you know, I was personally traveling with Prabhupada. So if anybody's interested to get this material, they do have Transcendental Diary down in the store there, and the BBT also, they have a stock. So if you want to get this material, you can get that from there. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.